Grandma Vera, it was awesome to see you.
What? You're...
It's cool. I don't think either of us has to feel bad about the fact that the timing isn't right for me to be here.
You're going to... Where will you go?
I have a tent and a camp stove and a love for the outdoors. I'll be all right.
You're in Manhattan.
Yeah, maybe you could give me a tip. Somewhere out of the way.
There's no place like that. Listen, you're be... Put that back down. Put it down. You can leave tomorrow. I won't stop you. Just sleep here for a few hours and take a shower and eat some breakfast. I can wash those. You smell terrible, and I wouldn't be surprised if you had lice.
I don't have lice.
And you don't seem all right to me. You don't seem all right.
That's from Amy Herzog's 4,000 Miles, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Drama. The play traces cross-generational connections between a 21-year-old, free-spirited young man estranged from his family and friends and his feisty 90-year-old grandmother. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. Joining me to discuss and sample the play 4,000 Miles are the director and cast members from Forward Theater's production of the play, performed at the Overture Center in Madison through November 20th. Jennifer Uphoff Gray is the director of Forward Theater, and with her are the two main actors in this play, Susan Sweeney, who plays the part of 91-year-old Vera, and Mitch Baltman, who plays her grandson Leo. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you for having us.
Let me start with you, Jennifer, about the play itself, because
sure.
I don't think Amy Herzog or the play 4,000 Miles are household words.
No.
Words. And I mean, we don't know this play the way we would know Raisin in the Sun or Romeo and Juliet or Glass Menagerie or something. It's a fairly new play. Tell us about it and why you chose it.
Sure. Well, anyone who knows anything about the work we do at Forward Theater knows this is exactly the kind of play we like to do, sort of the best of contemporary drama, telling stories about the world we live in now. And while Amy Herzog may not be a household name yet, I think she's going to be. She's really sort of in the vanguard of exciting new playwrights these days. This play, 4,000 Miles, was done in New York a couple of years ago. As you mentioned, it was a finalist for the Pulitzer. Time Magazine named it the best play of the year when it was up. And for the last couple seasons, it's been on the most produced plays list at professional companies across the country. But it hadn't been done yet here in Wisconsin. And we've had our eyes on it for a few seasons and finally had a slot that we could bring it here. And really, we were drawn both to the fact that it told a very touching story with a lot of humor. So we like it when it's smart and funny. But also because this really unique relationship that you very, very rarely get to see on stage or in film, for that matter, where you have a grandparent and a grandchild without that middle generation present sort of complicating and facilitating the interaction. So to see these two people from very different generations learn to communicate and support each other, it was really a unique opportunity.
Well, it's interesting, too, with Leo being 21, because he is an adult. So you have two adults here, but
technically
70 years between them,
yeah.
Which is and you're right, I can't think of another play offhand that has these two types of characters in it as the featured lead actors. This is a cynical question, but is one reason this play is produced so much that you could do it on a lower budget if you have a cast of, what, four actors?
Yeah, I mean, a cast of four is sort of a typical size these days. It's, you know, it's not just one or two, but I think the reason it's being done so often is because of that unique relationship at the heart of it. There's a lot of four-character plays out there that are not being done. So certainly the fact that it is not a cast of 20 makes it approachable, and it's not, multiple changing sets and all of that. But I really think it's been this popular because of this core relationship and the chance to see something really unique.
Do we ever leave Vera's apartment?
We never do.
So that reminds me then of Raisin in the Sun, where you're in one place with a family,
mm-hmm.
and the intensity that happens with those conversations.
Yep.
Yeah. So we heard a little tease coming into the hour of the two of them talking when Leo was about to leave. And I'd like to hear that scene a little in context with the opening of it. But before we do that, let me turn to our two actors here. Susan, can you tell us about the character of Vera a little bit and what drew you to being part of this production?
Well, Vera is, as you said, 90 years old or 90 plus. She is She's been a politically active woman her entire life in New York, has lived there her entire life. And she now has been a widow for 10 years. And she's at the point in her health life that she's beginning to lose both physical function, she doesn't get around so well anymore, and mental function. And that is the most frustrating thing for her because she's, as a person who has been a rabid political participator, she can no longer frame these arguments. And we get a lot of moments with her in this play where she laments that fact that her vocabulary is no longer present and she has to struggle for words. So not only is she losing physical function, but she's losing mental function. And then this grandson walks into her life, and it's this remarkable relationship where two people that distant from each other in age find a way to come together. And that certainly was the attraction for me to grapple with a woman like that. She is quite a force.
Mm. Well, that brings up the whole struggle with aging itself.
Yeah.
Mitch, what about Leo? What do you find in common with him, or what draws you into this character?
Several things. Leo is 21, and you mentioned that he was an adult, but at the same time, he really hasn't quite reached, especially at the beginning of the play. He's not necessarily mentally an adult yet. He has a lot of growing up to do yet, but he's also has a really good and big heart, and most of the time, however difficult it can be to view it at times, he really does come from a good place. It's always of the best intentions. And he really cares about people and their well-being. Yes, sometimes he looks at it through his own lens, and so it gets a bit murky. But he's a genuine guy who really wants the best for people, which I think is really relatable, period. Plus, he does sort of encapsulate my generation at times, and sometimes it can be slightly stereotypical, but at the same time, Amy writes in such a way that it is a slightly stereotypical character that is completely unique and completely individualistic. So it captures essences of the millennial generation while still being a unique individual and clearly distinct character. And so, like, that was a really fun challenge for me to take on, is something I can relate to as well. So,
Jennifer, can you set up the scene we're about to hear? Give us a little sense of physically what the apartment is like, where it is, when Leo arrives, why he's there, and just kind of set the scene.
Sure. So the excerpt that we're going to read in a moment is from the opening scene of the play. It takes place in Vera's apartment in Greenwich Village in Manhattan. It's a beautiful set. If you go to our website, you'll be able to see some pictures of it. Joe Varga, retired from the UW Theater Department, designed it. And you get this lovely sense of this place that Vera has spent decades of her life. And this first scene takes place about 3 o'clock in the morning. At the very top of the show, Leo's rung the buzzer and Vera's answered the door. She doesn't have her hearing aid in yet, doesn't have her teeth in yet. and she basically lets him in and then says, "Excuse me a moment." She goes off to get herself together. And then she reenters. She certainly had no idea that he was going to be showing up on her doorstep.
And how well do they know each other at this point? How much, closeness is there prior
to
this?
Sure. Well, they don't know each other very well at all. Leo's 21. He grew up in St. Paul. He's been living in Seattle for the last couple of years. It's made pretty clear in the script. He certainly has not been to New York in the 10 years, since his grandfather's funeral. We posited in the work and discussions we did in the rehearsal room that Vera probably visited them in St. Paul a couple of times, but maybe not in the last 4 or 5 years or so when he would have, been going from teenager to young adult. So we really don't think they know each other very well at all. Leo has gone through some things. He's been cycling across the country with his best friend from Seattle. And he's now shown up in New York at the end of that ride. And some things have happened that have been very traumatic for him. And, you know, we think he just kind of shows up at Grandma's because he doesn't have any place else to go.
Let's hear the scene.
Are you high?
What? No.
Well, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, so I'm just asking. Have you eaten anything in a while?
I'm cool.
That's not what I asked you. You've lost weight.
Well, it's been a long road, but a good one.
You biked all the way here?
Pretty much.
From Minnesota?
Actually, we started in Seattle.
There are some mountains in the middle, aren't there? Whichever way you go.
There are. There are.
I'll get you a banana.
No. Whoa, jet fuel.
What?
No such thing as a local banana.
You don't have to yell. It's only when you speak very low or very fast that I can't hear you.
I'm just concerned about you. I was leaning on the buzzer for quite a while.
Yes, well, I was asleep, and I didn't have my, hearing aid in, and I wasn't expecting you.
Would you hear a fire alarm?
What?
Would you hear a fire?
I heard you. Listen, it's the way you're acting I don't understand, actually. The whole family's been very worried. I guess you know that. Your mother and father.
I'm sorry. People worried. I am, but that's not something I can take responsibility for.
You should have called. You should have called your mother.
Grandma Vera.
She's really been...
Grandma Vera, it was awesome to see you.
What?
It's cool. I don't think either of us has to feel bad about the fact that the timing isn't right for me to be here.
You're going to... Where will you go?
I have a tent and a camp stove and a love for the outdoors. I'll be all right.
You're in Manhattan.
Yeah, maybe you could give me a tip somewhere out of the way.
There's no place like that. Listen, you're being... Put that back down. Put it down. You can leave tomorrow. I won't stop you. Just sleep here for a few hours and take a shower and eat some breakfast. I can wash those... You smell terrible, and I wouldn't be surprised if you had lice.
I don't have lice.
And you don't seem all right to me. You don't seem all right.
That does draw you right into these two characters right away. What are some of the things that you hear in that scene that set up the play?
Well, I think it's wonderful, first of all, to see Vera sort of quite quickly move into parenting mode with him, wanting to feed him, get him some sleep, you know, wash his clothes, but also not pussyfooting around the condition. You know, she tells him flat out, you don't look right and you smell and, you know, I'm worried about you. You've lost weight. I think any of us with a Jewish grandmother can relate to that. So I like seeing how she is both her own tough self, but also becomes very nurturing right away with him. And there's something, too, about how Leo works really hard to be extremely good-natured, at least on the surface. Cheerful, don't worry about it, no big deal. But the playwright's already starting to drop a few little clues that all is not right with him. And the play goes on from there. I think that she crams a lot into these opening moments.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it seems the minute that she starts in on him about calling his mother,
that goes right up.
He wants to walk out the door again. So, and it sets up a mystery at the beginning. You know, why is he not with his parents? What is it that has estranged him? Susan, I know one of your specialties is voice, dialect, all that. And I could hear some New York in your voice. Can you just tell me a little bit about what you do with your voice to capture the speech of Vera, who's lived all her life in
right.
New York?
Well, I think it's one of the – we discussed, Jen and I, how much of that dialect should be in there and decided that a certain amount of it was exactly the right thing to frame that place and also the contrast between the Midwestern kid and his grandmother. So I just worked with what would be a full-on, full-tilt dialect, Jewish background, urban dweller, Manhattan, and then toned it down and toned it down and toned it down until we thought we had the right level of it.
For some reason, I heard it a lot when you said, but you're in Manhattan. This is the way that hinted.
Manhattan, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, I remembered midway through rehearsal that people say Manhattan in Manhattan different from people elsewhere. We say Manhattan, and they say Manhattan. So little things like that can be illustrative of these differences. So,
and what do you do with your voice and also the body language, which obviously we can't see on radio, to capture someone who's 91?
Well, that's been quite a process. The playwright is very specific about how slowly Vera moves. And Vera herself talks about, besides her mental capacities becoming weaker, that her balance is not good. And we kind of put together over the course of the play that she's not getting out as much as she used to by any means, although we do hear that she does go out shopping, but she probably does that on a good day. And the first morning she and Leo have together, she's saying, it's a good thing I got some pastry from a buffet table at the senior center a couple of months ago that I could freeze it, because this morning I wasn't feeling completely up to it. So there are just all those things to put together. It's something that I needed Jen to keep telling me if this was believable, because there are 20 years between me and Vera, and no actor wants to be caught dead being a phony old person or a phony this person or a phony that person. So there were a lot of little pieces to put together with this. I did end up using my aunt, who died at 90 a few years ago and had a lot of difficulty physically. So I remembered how she was. I remember how she got herself out of furniture and how long it took her to stand there with her feet quite wide apart and wait until she was sure she had her balance before she would set off. So there were little things like that. And then we have a set with a step. So how does Vera get up the step was a big thing.
Well, it's interesting, too, because the two characters are kind of each worrying about the other. So Vera is worrying that, Leo hasn't eaten, he's dirty, and, what's kind of going on with him. But you also see Leo in that conversation that you just read, worrying that the buzzer was going. She didn't hear it. What would happen with a fire alarm? So what do you do, Mitch, to kind of convey this younger guy that sees an aging grandparent and feels, in a certain way, parental?
Yeah, it's really interesting because throughout the play, there's instances of Leo showing that he cares about his grandma. And yeah, in a way, sort of parenting her. There's a scene that happens later on in the play where I reveal to my sister that I'm trying to teach my grandma how to use Skype and things like that. So, but again, I really do think Leo comes from a place of caring as well. And even though he hasn't seen his grandma in a while and they're not necessarily the closest, they are still family and he does still care about her immensely. And especially, too, because Leo is coming off of a loss already, to see somebody at that stage in life where the image in his head, I don't believe, is the image that he's seen in front of him, because it has been some years since he's seen her. And that's always a hard thing to kind of grapple with. And so I think Leo is honestly trying to figure out how to help her and just make sure that, and sort of test the waters and assess where she's at in terms of the mental image that he had in his mind about where she was physically and mentally and health-wise.
One of the things that I really, really love about this play, though, is we start out at the very top and Vera is looking at Leo and going, ugh, I've got to take care of this kid. He's not in good shape. And Leo's looking at Vera and going, ugh, grandma's getting so old. Let me see how I can help her. But really, the story of the play is when each of them learns what the other is able to do for them to help them. You know, instead of, I'm going to help you, oh my gosh, you're helping me. And I don't think at the beginning that Vera thinks that there's anything Leo's going to be able to do to help her and vice versa. And it's lovely to see how they learn about each other and are benefited from that relationship.
Well, and Vera makes a point several times in the play of saying, in many ways, she says, I take care of myself. I've always been all right. Don't worry about me. And yet she really does needs someone there. She's mm-hmm. lonely. Mm-hmm. And her powers are failing. So mm-hmm. what do you do then?
And he's lonely, too.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
He's grieving and he's hurting. And he's a 21-year-old young man or boy even and doesn't really want to admit that he needs help and needs mm-hmm. comfort.
And one of the things that we talked about, too, is how Leo and Vera kind of come into each other's life at exactly the right time for each other. And they're both at a point where they both need each other, but they don't necessarily know that they need each other. And they give each other just exactly what they need in that exact moment that they need it. And that's such another unique thing about this play is that it doesn't feel forced, though. It just feels like it's kind of like the perfect storm of family coming together and doing what it should at the time when we need it the most.
And yet what's also hilarious and true to the family dynamic is they drive each other completely up the wall.
Absolutely.
I mean, there are some hilarious scenes. I mean, if you can imagine a 21-year-old and a 91-year-old having to live under the same roof for a few weeks.
In a Manhattan apartment.
I mean, it is.
And all kinds of little things where she finds a package of condoms in the laundry advance or has to weigh in on whether his girlfriends are the right weight or, you know, all kinds of things that make this less than just a – I mean, it's not a Hallmark drama about it.
No.
It's not that. It's
not remotely.
It's quite prickly, the relationship.
Quite prickly. And we're going to look more at the prickly play to 4,000 Miles when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Jennifer Uphoff-Gray, Susan Sweeney, and Mitch Bultman, the director and two lead actors in Forward Theater's production of Amy Herzog's 4,000 Miles. We've been sampling this play, mostly centering on a 21-year-old who's biked from Seattle to Manhattan and shown up at 3 in the morning at the door of his 91-year-old grandmother. I want to kind of zoom in on these two characters. It would be easy to make this a cheesy drama, to make the, you know, this sort of frail grandmother who's kind of reunited with the young grandson and somehow you can almost hear the violin music starting and everything else. And this,
I would never do that play.
But you've called it prickly. But let's talk about the grandmother, Vera. Susan, you are given these lines that a playwright has written for you, so you're working within that. First of all, can you say something about what you think of the language that Amy Herzog gives you as an actress in this play?
It's been one of the most pleasurable aspects of doing this play is working with a playwright who really knows how to write character in dialogue. And I'm just completely taken with how specifically she has written each of the characters, each of the four characters in the play. They all, each of them has a different rhythm, a different sense of how they talk to other people. It's so specific, which to an actor is the best gift of all. I'm struck, for example, with Vera, I'm struck by the number of dashes in the punctuation, the number of ellipses in the punctuation, how she will punctuate. Vera says, what do you call it, a lot, because she keeps losing her vocabulary. But sometimes it's, for example, this line, Ben and Mel got it for me, but I'm not, comma, what do you call it, comma, or no, what do you call it, period. But sometimes that what do you call it will be separated by commas, which I have made up means that she's really got to go in search of it. But I'm not, what do you call it. But sometimes she has no commas, setting off the what do you call it. So then it's the pro-peace what do you call it is a different mental function that she has written. And I think one of the reasons she might be that specific about this character is that she based it on her beloved grandmother, who appears in, I think, several of the plays, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So she must have really been studying how mm-hmm. this woman talked. And how do you set that down on the page for the actor so that the actor can get as specific with that moment of the brain working toward words as possible? So I really love the way she writes.
Is there a moment in the play where sort of your character is showcased as the way she talks and thinks? That you could give us a sample of? I know this isn't like the sort of to be or not to be soliloquy exactly, but most plays, I would think, actors have these moments that they're sort of looking forward to every night because it allows them to really give us a sense of the character that they're playing.
There's
a bit at the top of scene four.
Scene four. She's in the presence of expecting it to be a conversation, but neither of them really knows what to say to the other. So Vera kind of steps in with this long investigation of her marriage to her first husband. With each episode of this marriage, she expects Rebecca to chime in so they can have a conversation, but Rebecca never does. So Vera just keeps talking. I can start at the top of that section. After a silence, Vera says, "When I was first married, not to Joe, to my first husband, Arthur, it was a week or two we had been married, and a woman showed up at our apartment with luggage. Arthur said to me, 'Oh, I forgot to tell you, before we were married, I promised I would take her away for the weekend, and I didn't want to think on a promise.' So I said, 'All right,' and they went away, and I left my key on the piano and went home to my parents." And then Rebecca says, "And you divorced him?" "Oh, no. He came to my parents at the end of the weekend begging and pleading, and I thought it was funny that he'd been so stupid, so I went home with him. It wasn't the last time he cheated." So that's an example of, and there are lots of those sentences have no commas. So she's going on. "It was a week or two we'd been married, and a woman showed up at our apartment with luggage." Or, "He came to my parents at the end of the weekend begging and pleading, and I thought it was funny that he had been so stupid, so I went home with him." So that's a very particular kind of talker.
And is she telling this young woman that with a particular purpose in mind?
Well, yes, I think so. Jen and mm-hmm. I talked about that quite a bit, and Jen, and I agree with Jen that it's what she ends up saying is men sometimes do stupid things, and essentially you have to forgive them because she and Leo are on the outs. And I think, you know, Vera's trying to broker a little bit to get this relationship happening. I don't know what the intent is, but Rebecca doesn't participate in it. And so
there's also some conversations Vera has with characters who are never seen on stage, like the neighbor.
Yeah.
That where it's, if I remember right, they check in on each other to make sure they haven't died overnight.
Yes.
Can you talk about that and some of the kind of we hear phone calls, and I always have thought that phone calls would be difficult to do on stage because if you did them realistically, there'd be a lot of silence,
mm-hmm.
but that's boring. So I wonder if you could talk about the phone calls.
Well, that is another thing that this playwright writes very insistently, pauses. So there's something called pause, and then there's something called pause, pause, and then there's something called a long pause, and then there's something called a very long pause. There's also a brief pause. So she's writing rhythms, and so those phone call rhythms are pretty specific. Some of them are short pauses. Some of them are, there's a long thing that Ginny is saying on the other end of the line. Yeah, Ginny is an interesting thing because what we've found is that there are lots of clues in the script that even though Vera says, "For some reason, we don't go to each other's houses," some idea she has about privacy. But then you find out at other times that Vera keeps Sweet and Low for Ginny because Ginny's a diabetic and Vera has seen all of Ginny's plants. So there are little mysteries mm-hmm. there.
What I love about the presence of Ginny in the story is this sense of Vera setting up her life in a way that allows her to still remain in her home. She's 91. She's living alone in this apartment in New York City. My grandmother was living alone in her apartment in New York City at the same age. And the sense that, Vera has reached out. She has a neighbor across the hall. They talk to each other once a day to make sure they're both okay, that she's – Vera's figuring out how to make life work, at least for now, in a way that allows her to still be independent. And I think she's sort of staring down the future where – anything, the wrong slip and fall and the broken hip puts an end to that, or the wrong illness, or, who knows what. Any little thing could upset that balance. But the presence of Ginny as this offstage character illustrates the ways in which Vera is setting up her life to allow herself to remain independent as long as possible.
Mm-hmm. And what about Leo? Let's talk about that character and some of the you have some monologues in the play, Mitch.
Totally.
Can you give us some sense of, first of all, the parts of the play that you're sort of every night when you do this performance, you're looking forward to doing, and also some parts where you feel something about you is revealed through your speech?
Totally. Well, as we sort of touched on before, Leo arrives at Vera's apartment at 3 a.m. after just finishing a bike trip, and he's hurting. He's in a lot of pain. And sort of in a state of shock, even though the event that caused the pain happened roughly over 2 months ago. So he's in denial and shock, and it's interesting because the way the play is written, we don't really find out what that event was until about, I would say 80% through the play. And that moment, he has this big, long monologue. It's late again in the morning. Leo's sitting alone on the couch. And Vera comes in, not expecting to see Leo there. She flicks on the light, sees him sitting there, flicks it off, and comes and just sits next to him and is with Leo in a time where, whether she knows it or not, he desperately needs her. And in this safety and cover of darkness, Leo begins to tell this story in a way that he desperately, so desperately needs to tell. And just has Vera there to listen, which is all he needs. So that's a part that it's so critical to Leo's journey to have this moment. So I guess I'll do a little snippet of that, and we'll see where it goes. We were in Kansas. Because even though that was way out of the way, we wanted to hit the center of the country, preferably around the 4th of July for maximum earnestness / unacknowledged irony factor. The timing worked out, so it was July 3rd, and we were approaching Gypsum, our small town America of choice. One bar, one diner, 17 churches, or whatever. And we were going west to east, so the wind at our backs. Well, the wind comes out of the south in the summertime, but more like the southwest. So in a way, going west to east was a weak move on our part. But we kind of wanted to do the opposite of the historical. Like, America is east to west, so we were going the opposite way. Also, we lived out west, so it was more honest to start there. Western Kansas is like bored flat. The cliche. So you're basically just riding the wind, and if you pedal a little bit, even in a low gear, you can hit 15 miles per hour, no problem. 15 miles per hour is a pretty slow speed in a car, but on a bike, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. So it's morning, and the sun's low. Between the low sun, the flat ride, it's a perfect time to take shadow pictures.
Hmm. And what difference do you think it makes that Vera is listening to that? Because she's obviously not interrupting you. Or...
Yep. It's interesting. For something that I won't fully reveal right now. but at the same... Leo just needs somebody to listen to it.
A witness.
A witness. He doesn't need comments. He just needs to have that catharsis and have that ability to get this off of his chest and take off this coat of burden that he has been hauling around and literally biking across the country with for the past 2.5 months.
No, that scene didn't reveal the burden exactly, the hurt.
No, but it puts him on the right path. Mm-hmm. It allows him to take that first step towards recovery. It allows him to take that leap into, I can now move past this because I've addressed what actually happened. Whereas before, he was in denial in a way that he wouldn't talk about it, he wouldn't think about it. And as we sort of have posited and talked about in rehearsal, after the events of what happened, we really think that Leo just woke up in the morning, he rode as far as his legs would take him to the point where he was exhausted, he got off his bike, and he went to bed. And he woke up, and he repeated this process, so he didn't have to think about what had transpired. And so when he lands in New York, even though it's 2 months later, he still hasn't done any of the processing, and so... this moment allows him to start processing that. And as, you need to process before you can move on. And so I think this is the processing moment. It's sort of the hinging point in his trajectory. Because after this, Leo goes and he gets a job interview and he connects with his sister and he makes steps to move back towards... becoming a more responsible member of society.
And do you want to talk about the hurt and the circumstance, or are we going to leave that a mystery here?
Well, I mean, he's experienced a loss. He's mm-hmm. experienced a loss, and at a young age where he doesn't really have a lot of experience coping with that. And I think that's really all you need to know. And because whether people have a chance to come and see the show with us or to read the script or to see another production, you want to give everyone an opportunity to learn that over, mm-hmm. as the play unfolds. But I think in terms of talking about what's going on with him, it's that he's experienced a deep loss and has been in denial about his need to process it.
It's interesting, too, because Vera, although it's been 10 years since her husband's died, she hasn't changed the name on mm-hmm. the... I mean, she still has his name outside mm-hmm. on the buzzer, so there's kind of a delayed processing mm-hmm. there as well mm-hmm. in yeah. some sense. And do you think that the loss is what brings them together? They both have something there. They're both lonely in a sense. They're both estranged mm-hmm. from others, and they're both dealing with loss.
For sure. And Vera is experienced now at dealing with loss. I mean, at age 91, it's not just her husband, it's her friend. She goes to a couple of different funerals over the course of the play. There are things that Leo can teach her about the world as it now is. But she obviously has a great deal to teach him about how to deal with something and go forward. It's a really beautiful thing to see them both. To see them each learning from the other.
One of the things that can happen sometimes is that it's difficult for a young adult to even imagine that someone in their 90s once was young, like they were, once had all kinds of experiences. And, we saw the conversation where she's talking about different, philandering husband and so on. But what are some other instances in the play, Susan, where Vera reveals things about her own activism or her own unconventional behavior that you think would make Leo recognize, oh, my grandmother wasn't always 91 and missing her teeth and her hearing aid?
Well, he doesn't hear this, but his former girlfriend does, that Vera talks about with this philandering husband. She says, they went to Cafe Society. So we did some research on Cafe Society and looked at some photos and saw the groundbreaking thing that that club was, the first integrated jazz club. And those pictures were remarkable. So I made up, I was able to make up from that, that I mean, the whole excitement of nightlife combined with politics, combined with going out and protesting for peace, peace needs. And she was out there, and she parented her second husband's children. So she never had any of her own. But I think she's had a pretty full life, and which is another thing, another thing at this moment that she regrets. She can't get out there and do it anymore. Mm-hmm. So
one of the instances that I think of where I think Leo realizes that she wasn't always a 91-year-old woman is there's a moment in a scene where I'm reading a book about the Cuban healthcare system that was edited by my grandfather. And in reading this, I think Leo discovers not necessarily all of the actions and all of the incredible things that my grandmother has done, but the way they thought about life, I think Leo totally sees in a way that is eye-opening for him. And there's this moment where, and I have this line where I talk about how I think it must have been cool to be so uncynical. Mm-hmm. So I think that was a moment of realization in reading my grandpa's book that he edited, where I
what else do you say there?
I think it must have been cool to be so uncynical. Like, I think I'm totally uncynical, and Micah was definitely totally uncynical. But you guys, man, that was like a whole other level of... I think it must have been cool. I'm learning about Grandpa. It's definitely cool.
Yeah, that's a good example of sort of realizing that these grandparents, they had their own lives and they're interesting in and of themselves. What about from the standpoint of the other direction where Vera discovers that Leo's not this kid anymore, that he actually has some sort of personality of his own, some thoughts of his own. I think there's even a point where he says something and she thinks it's Confucius, but it's actually something he came up with.
Yeah. Well, they have this wonderful interaction about Marx, where she recognizes that he's somehow interested in the same tracks that she was interested in. So they have a moment of bonding.
We're going to look at that scene and more from the play 4,000 Miles when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Jennifer Uphoff Gray, Susan Sweeney, and Mitch Bultman from the Forward Theater's production of Amy Herzog's play, 4,000 Miles, a play about a 91-year-old grandmother reunited with her 21-year-old grandson. And we were talking about ways that these two, who are separated by 70 years and also separated by lots of years where they didn't really know each other very well, now they're living in the same apartment. They start finding some interesting overlap in ideology, some ways that they can learn from each other. And right before we broke, you talked about there's a scene that refers to Marx. Jennifer, can you set that up before we hear it?
Sure. So this is, a few days into the time that Leo's been living at Vera's apartment. And looking for a way to connect with her. She's had a rough morning. She went to a funeral and of an old friend, and he sort of sees that and tries to broach a conversation with her, and this is where it goes.
Do you have a computer?
No, I... Well, yes, I have one. Ben and Mel got it for me, but I'm not... What do you call it? They were very happy with themselves for getting it for me, but they didn't really show me what to do with it.
Mac or PC?
What?
We'll look at it later.
You know a lot about computers?
I don't like them, but I can use them.
I thought everyone your age liked them.
Micah never sent an email. His whole life. Which was stubborn as shit, but you kind of have to admire it.
Did he use the telephone?
Yeah, but he didn't have a cell phone. I don't have one either.
I know you don't. I've been hearing about that a lot lately. I guess what they say is all this, what's it, technology is good for, from the standpoint of the people, or the, that you can get the propaganda to the people. The Marxist, I can't find the words, but in terms of Africa and South America and places where, that from the standpoint of being progressive and so on and so forth, it can be a good thing. You know, the worst thing about getting old, and there are a lot of bad things, is not being able to find my words. I just hate not being able to find my words. I feel like an idiot half the time.
That it's democratizing.
What?
That with the internet, information is free to everyone. It decommodifies knowledge, which is power.
Huh. When you put it that way, I think I should learn to use the computer.
Marx is cool.
You think so?
Yeah, he's all right.
Well, I think so, too.
When I did that semester at Evergreen, I took a class on Marx. Best class I took.
What did your mother think of that?
About me studying Marx?
Yeah.
I think she was like, how is this going to be useful to you in your future?
Oh, dear.
Yeah, and I was like, first of all, who knows? And second, I think it's important to understand where I come from, which is where you come from, too. So I'm surprised you aren't more supportive.
You said that.
I did.
And what did she say?
Oh, you know, as long as I was in college, she was happy, so I think she just stopped talking.
She and I don't talk about politics anymore. I always end up telling her how disappointing she was to her father. I don't mean to. Somehow or other, I just wind up saying it. And I only mean in terms of the political, not generally. But then she starts crying and going on about how she always votes Democrat, as if that's... it's better we just don't talk about it.
I find that to be true about a lot of subjects with Jane.
Well, between you and me, I guess I do too.
That's another one of these characters that's in the play but not in the play,
yeah.
Is this mother. And we see that the son is referring to her by the first name.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's this middle generation that's not represented in the play.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
I think that if Vera's daughter, Leo's mother, was present, that would suck all the energy out of the room.
Mm-hmm.
And it would block any direct connection between these two. She can be off stage, out of the scene, as a you know, shared relationship that these two have, that they can bond over their love for and exasperation with this woman. But if she were there, I don't think they would ever be able to connect in this way.
Well, I think there's something interesting, too, because I don't necessarily feel like Leo felt, at least at the top of the play, like he could go home, go back to St. Paul, go back to being with his mom. So I think it would completely and utterly change the dynamic if Jane showed up at some point mm-hmm. in the show.
I'm guessing that there are lots of families that can relate to the idea that you cannot talk about politics or, you know, just that a family is sort of this assemblage of people who don't always agree with each other, but they're supposed to love each other despite those differences. And I'm curious with, you know, since you have had a lot of performances, also some outreach work, what kinds of responses you've gotten from people who say, yeah, that's my family, or I can relate to this.
Yeah. We've gotten a lot of it. I mean, I think that's part of what's so lovely about this play is that these are such relatable, recognizable characters. Whether or not you have a 91-year-old communist Jewish grandmother living in New York, you've had grandparents. Maybe you knew them well. Maybe you didn't. You know, maybe you're lucky enough that you're at a point in life where you have grandchildren. We talked about that a lot in rehearsal, just sharing all of our own reflections on our family members. And the audience members at our talkbacks have talked about that quite a bit as well. Both recognizing the characters in their age and in their youth, but also just the types of characters that these are, even though this is a very New York-centric story, and with the presence of Leo having come from St. Paul by way of Seattle, they're so recognizable here in Madison. It's part of what drew us to the play, this, you know, this aging lefty that Vera represents. I think, you know, we're certainly in the company of many such here in Madison, and Leo representing the sort of more modern hipster millennial progressive
biker.
Exactly. We put the cyclist thing in on top of that. It's just extra recognizable here. And so it's nice that we can do a play that has such a specific setting and yet one that feels so universally recognizable here in our community.
And briefly, for each of you, if the play succeeds, what would an audience member go out of the theater feeling or thinking or doing differently?
That's a tough question. But I really think that this play is so much about relationships and being there for people when they need it. And if people go and leave the play and they call their grandparent or they call their grandchild or even their parents, if you know, depending on the age, it doesn't matter.
Or if they Skype.
Or they Skype, totally. This play is so much about connection and reconnecting and finding your way back into and finding your family, because technically Vera and Leo, Vera is technically Leo's step-grandma, but it really doesn't matter because family transcends blood. And I really think that that's important. And that's, I guess, that's what I would like people to take away the most.
And for you, Jennifer?
Well, it's, if there's a takeaway of this play, it's the value in listening to each other, which I think we need now more than ever. You know, these are two people who have not had a chance to talk very much about what they've experienced in their lives. Vera has a much longer life history to talk about, but Mitch has some, Leo has some very recent things that are on his chest. And what they're able to do for each other by listening and how that benefits them, not just the person being heard, is pretty profound. And I think it's a lovely thing to go home thinking about, to have an evening in the theater with two really kind of funny and real and, as you said, prickly characters, this relatable family story, but then to go home thinking about the value of listening to each other, that would be a gift, I think.
Well, it's been a gift to have the three of you here. I'm Emily Auerbach. Our guests have been Jennifer Uphoff Gray, Susan Sweeney, and Mitch Baltman from Forward Theater. I'm Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Year.